Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn. This is the final program in a four-part series on the mauling of mission. So far, we've discussed the impact of our culture of marketing on the church. We've also heard interviews from a recent conference to illustrate the problem. And first, we considered the ways in which consumption has become the dominant worldview in our culture. Usually, we think of ourselves as consuming Coke or consuming pork chops, but in our culture today, a culture of consumption, everything is there for us to use for our own fleeting happiness. We don't just watch movies, we consume the lives exhibited in them. We try on their characters as one might try on a new suit or dress at the mall. It affects our relationships and is no doubt one of the reasons for such a high divorce rate in our society. We're all trying to be somebody new every Thursday. And if you're not completely satisfied, simply return the unused portion for a full refund. If things don't work for us, we'll just move on to something else. And this happens in church all the time. We then went on to discuss the danger of taking God's name in vain, of using Him to validate our own habits of consumption, especially in the supposed interest of reaching the lost. As we wrap up our series on the mauling of mission, we'll be turning from critique to construction. How can we get out of this mess? Jesus Christ is the answer. No, I'm not being glib, although that assertion is often used as a superficial slogan. Once we flesh it out a bit, we see why Jesus is the answer. Jesus is the answer according to his threefold office of prophet, priest, and king, an office which he exercises in this real world of sin and death through the ministry of word and sacrament. Now here is a real signs and wonders ministry. Here, consumers are drowned in order to be raised to newness of life, to really find real needs that they never knew they had. Here, those who at first came to church today to be affirmed in their habits of consumption have realized that there is a far more important need than feeling affirmed and being successful in life. They've had the interior doors thrown open to expose the real state of their hearts and have fled for safety to the Father through the Son by the powerful working of the Spirit through the gospel. Now, if the new megachurches are modeled on the shopping mall, our churches will have to be modeled on that community under the cross about which we've read so often in church history. Like so many theologies of glory, the mall promises, have it all, have it now, have it your way. Sure, it costs more, but you're worth it. So why would someone respond to the call to come and die? The Apostle Paul explains, if we have died with him, we shall also be raised with him. But how does this play out in actual practice, in evangelism, worship, and life? We'll discuss these issues and more on this edition of the White Horse Inn. Jesus is the answer. Is that glib? I mean, we say that sometimes in a way of dismissing the real problems and challenges of thinking through the issues.
If someone says that to me, they've got about 2 or 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it becomes glib depending on what we are providing him as the answer to. When the question is, well, how can I be happy, wealthy, and wise? And then we just retort, well, Jesus is the answer. Or how do I get over my cholesterol problem? Well, Jesus is the answer.
That's so you mean the world doesn't get to decide what the questions are, then the church answers it?
Well, that has been the case, but obviously when we understand the person and work of Christ, as you mentioned, Mike, in your commentary, in his threefold office, then when we say Jesus is the answer, he is the answer to man's most basic need and most basic problem, which is to be reconciled to God, which makes sense of the rest of the created order. Otherwise, it does become glib.
Is preaching then a lot like marketing, at least in this respect? Neither is content with passively accepting the felt needs of the market. Both labor to generate a new set of felt needs. I mean, one thing that the culture of marketing does is create a need for things that I don't really need, so that there will then be a market where there was none. Isn't that what preaching does also in a different way? Through the preaching of the law, it creates ex nihilo, really, almost, a need that we never knew we had. Now that need is not just a superficial felt need, but it's, goodness gracious, this is like the felt need of seeing an oncoming car. And then the preaching of the gospel that creates faith in the heart. Isn't the culture of marketing and preaching similar?
Except, yes, except for the fact that they understand the 10th commandment differently. For to preach the law, we say coveting is a sin. To preach marketing, we say you should and it's good.
Huh.
And the difference is a question of perspective. I mean, the marketing-driven approaches tell us that if you have a felt need, fill it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Christian preacher says the desire to fill every felt need that arises is sin.
Well, I think the point of comparison that you're making, though, is a legitimate comparison, because when you look at Paul's words, he says, well, I never knew coveting until I understood the law.
Until the law was preached to him.
And so, yes, in that sense, we do make people aware of a need and a problem that in their fallen state, they're not aware that they have.
To add a little bit to that, there's the effect of what God does through the preached law and the preached gospel, and the emphasis is on he who is holy, on him who is holy, and then it's on him who is rescued, in a way that when we're talking about preaching to felt needs, we're always looking at ourselves primarily, and in a way, the preaching of the law and the gospel only in a tangential way has to do with how much can I look at myself again.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Sure.
I mentioned throughout this series John Seabrook's book, No Brow, The Culture of Marketing, The Marketing of Culture. I mean, it's not at all a Christian book, but he's analyzing the way marketing really has become the culture of America. What marketing does, he says, is it rips off that which the culture legitimately produces, mass markets it back to the culture, selling it back, and we pay for it. And it's no longer selling, for instance, furniture that is of the finest quality, but selling our self-identity. When we say, for instance, that we like something, what are we really saying? He says, when you say about a painting, a music video, or a pair of jeans, I like this, you make some sort of judgment, but it's not a judgment of quality. In No Brow, judgments about which brand of jeans to wear are more like judgments of identity than quality. These judgments do not depend on knowledge of the canon, tradition, history, or some shared set up standards about what constitutes the good to give them weight. This kind of taste is more like appetite than discerning judgment. Taste is the act of making the thing part of your identity. Fanship, brandship, and relationships are all part of what the statement, I really like this, means. Your judgment joins a pool of other judgments, a small relationship economy, one of millions that continually coalesce and dissolve and reform around cultural products, movies, sneakers, jeans, pop songs. These culture equities rise and fall in the stock market of popular opinion, and therefore one has to manage one's portfolio of investments with care. No value endures. Everything shifts in the marketplace of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
What we're buying is self-images. When I say I really like that, what I really mean is I really like myself as that person embodied in that advertisement or some such thing. To what extent is that a part of what's going on with the church growth movement?
Well, when you have sermon topics that are geared toward success in life kinds of things, to problem solving, to motivation, you're creating an image of a happy, satisfied, successful individual in whatever station in life they happen to be that a person identifies with and tries to be like, which is like emulating a character in a television show. That person doesn't exist anywhere historically. The preacher sets out an image, and people try and emulate that image and trying to live up, whether it be a person of faith or whatever. When in fact, the scriptures speak to real human problems, sin and grace, and whereas God addresses us as individuals he has known from before the foundation of the world through the preaching of that gospel. Even though the sermon strikes the hearer as though it were intensely personal, it really is impersonal. Right. It's an image thing. You've created a scenario in which the person tries to fit themselves in. When God speaks to us directly as individuals by calling us through the preaching of the gospel in response to the law, which has already condemned us, it seems to me that there's the great reversal here, the great switch, that we think this is personal, that it's felt needs, but it really is an image, a myth.
Well, too, when we think about life as a drama and ourselves as sort of being scripted into a play, the culture has scripted us as consumers.
Mm-hmm.
That's our character. That's the character we play, and it gets worked out in the script. But in the biblical script, we are swept into the drama of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't this one way of responding, to say, look, as ministers, we have an opportunity every Lord's Day to re-script people. They have been scripted by the world in deformed ways, ways that are not only not glorifying to God, but are harmful to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, you present a serious challenge, because people, the script is being reinforced in almost every other segment of society. And then to come to the church on Sunday, as you mentioned earlier, 2 hours a week, and try to tell people you are not the image that you have been mm-hmm. led to believe by every other segment of the culture, you're the one that's going to sound like you have a strange message.
Nor is the image that the culture is presenting to you desirable. The culture says you should be like this.
Yes.
Whereas God says something entirely different in many cases, and that's a real collision.
One of the things I love about C.S. Lewis and his approach to the whole question of needs and pleasures is he charges us with not being too eager to be satisfied, but for settling for less.
So little. Yes. Yeah.
We're like children making mud pies in the slums because we can't even imagine what it would be like to have a holiday at the sea.
Right.
Rereading Romans 1 and 2 sort of made me wonder, you know, with all of the talk there about the chronology of sin, what happens to a people, to an individual, to a culture, to a race, the human race? What happens when, first of all, they decide that they will not retain a knowledge of God? They're going to get rid of theology. They're going to get rid of any acknowledgement of God's law or his gospel, then get rid of any kind of sense of his presence in the culture, even in a civil way, until finally they get to the point where they exchange natural love for homosexuality, and they start worshiping created things rather than the Creator, and so forth. You get down that. But the thing all the way through there is that they are doing what they want to do. It made me wonder. I know it's somewhat speculative, but based on Romans 1 and 2, I've wondered, isn't hell possibly the place where people get what they always wanted forever?
Yeah.
Yeah, I maintain that Frank Sinatra's I Did It My Way is the theme song of hell.
It's sort of like the woman who started out living promiscuously, and then finally she went into prostitution, and she'll be doing tricks forever in hell. And the self-righteous person will be climbing up the ladder of morality forever in hell.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it isn't as if that's foreign to Romans 1. In Romans 1, the curse is that he gives them what they ask for.
Yeah, exactly.
He gives them over to their felt needs.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's not foreign to the Bible. Yeah. Romans 1, you're not speculating really that far. And you mentioned the chapter before you said it.
Yeah.
That's the way it's worded.
Do you think if that's the case, if that's true, that we ought to be going down a different road in our preaching then and in our ministry? It's not just the preaching, but this infuriates me. I have heard when it's Youth Sunday or when it's Sunday School for the Kids, the very worst moralism that we have to dish out, we dish out to the kids.
Yes.
Why? Why do we have to inoculate them against the gospel before they reach adulthood?
It's a sad commentary.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't we be already telling them what their real needs are and saying, look, we're going to prove this from the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
We're not scolding you. We're not attacking you.
Right.
We're saying, welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You're a human
yeah.
being. We're a human being. Here's our mess. And now what has God done? What would Jesus do, but what has Jesus done?
I've probably told the story before of taking my boy out of Sunday school for theological reasons. He brought home his little picture that he colored in Sunday school. He was in second grade. It was a picture of a boy, and he was standing in the backyard of a Midwest house. And there was a garage there with a basketball hoop, and you could look in the back window and see his mother with a stack of dishes, and she was working her tail off washing dishes. And there was a bunch of leaves on the lawn and a rake untouched by anybody. And the caption underneath that thing was, "What do you think Johnny could do right now to show how much he loved Jesus?"
Oh, God.
And I took him out of I told the Sunday school superintendent, "I've got to withdraw my son. You're going to make an atheist out of him within a few years." Mm-hmm. And she, of course, had no idea what that meant. And I got a call from the pastor the next day. He said, "I heard you withdrew your son from our Sunday school." I said, "I had to, Lauren. You were going to make an unbeliever out of him."
Must have happened to a lot of people Ted's age, because right now, you know, you look around, and a lot of the people from the baby boomer generation and younger just don't go to church because they were raised with that miserable stuff.
Oh, it's awful.
I remember an old White Horse Inn many, many years ago played that song from Nirvana.
Oh, okay.
You remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, God don't want me for a son.
God don't want me. And that whole, you know, where these guys rise up and shake their fist. R.E.M. They rise up and they shake their fist in the face of the church. That stuff you're talking about, Rod, breeds that reaction.
Of course it does.
And it should.
And then what's hilarious is you get from church growth gurus, "Well, the moralism is the hook."
Oh.
Moralism is what drove them out.
Well,
figure it out, people. We want to hear, as Lewis said, a song from a faraway country.
Yeah. You know, it might just tell how apostate I really am, but I understand Sam Kinison.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I understand Sam Kinison.
Yeah, I don't like him, but I understand him. And it grieves you to hear the
and Jessica Hahn.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Roman George Carlin.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah, I mean, think about all the Hugh Hefner was in a strict Methodist family growing up.
Oh.
Shirley MacLaine, a strict Southern Baptist home. Mm. And you go down the list. Ted Turner, strict fundamentalist upbringing. When are we going to get the message that we're producing secularism in our culture?
That's what moralism does to people.
But it's amazing. You know, you mentioned the children and the bad stuff we give them. All we've done is stepped it up. I mean, we've actually done the reverse. In Scripture and historically what the church has done is take doctrine and present it at a level children could understand in the form of the catechisms.
Yep.
Now we've dummied it down and tried to make it palatable to the children. And on the other hand, we've taken the real message and have dummied it down for the parents as well.
Yeah. Right.
Do you and your churches have resources so that there's a children's message that's other than moralism?
No.
Every children's sermon nearly that I have ever heard is the most moralistic part of the service.
Oh.
At Christ Reformed Church, we are down.
At that time of the service, if I had young children still, I would take them out so they didn't hear it.
Hurry,
let's rush out.
We're down to using the English Bible for our curricula for our grade schools because we can't find curricula that isn't moralistic.
Oh.
So we've got people from Westminster and other places doing redemptive history from the scriptures for our kids.
Yeah.
We just use the catechisms and just work from the questions on the catechisms as the curriculum for our children's Sunday school.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the catechisms were made for.
Think of, it reminds me of the Hippocratic Oath. The first line is, "First, do no harm."
Yeah.
Right. And I think of those committees or individuals who produce children's sermon materials.
Yep.
Theological illiterates writing for children.
And they really should be shipping these out for people in the Midwest when the price of oil goes up and they can't afford to heat their homes during the mid-winter. And they could take those books of children's sermons and use them for fuel to heat their homes.
Yes. This is what we're going to have to come back to. At the end of the day, God is the author of the church. He is the author of its message, and he's the author of its methods. And it really comes down to whether we think, as you pointed out, Ken, that God is the one who does the saving.
Yep.
If we think that we're the ones who do the saving, then thank you very much, Charles Finney. We'll be inventing new measures until the cows come home. But these are the old measures that have worked down through the ages because they're the methods God has promised to bless. Where the word is rightly preached and the sacraments are rightly administered, there you have no doubt is a true church. And I really do think that we're going to have to, again, ask that very difficult question of ourselves and of our culture. Is there in our midst a true church? I mean, that's a difficult question for us to deal with. But at the very least, the preaching of the Holy Gospel, is that present? In whenever it's present, it is present in power. The Holy Spirit doesn't do his little freelance thing over here, and then the gospel does this over here.
Doesn't create gold out of your palms.
That's right. The Spirit works with the gospel. He's not on his own freelance mission. And so the question really is the gospel being clearly preached?
Now, when you ask the question, are we really a true church, then I think we're going to have to define that according to different standards than the ones that we are receiving. Because how are people defining whether or not they are a legitimate church? Again, by tangible things, by the numbers that are coming in, by the effectiveness, quote unquote, of different ministries. That's how they're defining it, not in terms of the message that's being proclaimed. Or the quality of discipleship in terms of understanding the basic doctrines of the faith.
Well, the question has shifted from what is a true church to what is a successful church.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, we need to take our own hits here. You know, we can very easily sit on our laurels and say, oh, well, I mean, I know a lot of people who in our own circles who might take great pleasure in hearing us criticize the church growth movement, because that allows us to be lazy and we don't have to reach out to the lost. We don't have to care about the hungry and the homeless. We don't have to do anything, because after all, we're the true church, not the successful church. And they're proving that as best they can.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. In our circles, I don't know if it's like this in Dutch circles, but in German Missouri Synod circles, it's sort of a free pass to go back to doing it the way we did in 1954.
Yeah. Well, this is not your father's Oldsmobile. This is not a cry from Reform ministers to have, or Lutheran ministers to have, a church that looked like it did in 1960.
Right.
Because
right.
What was going on in 1960 in many ways was as bad and as evil as what's going on today. I see Ken sitting here and think, I heard one evangelical leader talking about going back to the glories of the post-Korean War era, and I thought, you know, tell that to Ken.
Yeah,
yeah, please,
right,
thank
right,
you.
Right, spare me.
Have you heard of the civil rights movement?
Yeah, so this can't be a traditionalist return to the past. This has to be a return to the law and the gospel.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's a great note to end on. Folks, we've been talking about the mauling of mission. Jesus Christ gave us a mission. We don't need a new mission statement. The other one has worked perfectly well for 2,000 years. Go into all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing them and teaching them everything that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. We'll be with you next week again as we start a new series on the White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorsein.org.